Welcome to our webinar. If you join us a little bit after this, you can catch up. My name is Amanda Trigg, and I am a fellow out of the New Jersey chapter, or the American chapter, USA chapter of the IAFL. As you join us, I invite you to mark your calendars for future upcoming events if you are not already a fellow of the IAFL. Friday, March 19th, 2021, there will be a webinar about European family law. The 5th of February, there will be a webinar about expansion to Africa. And on the 14th of May, 2021, there will be a particular outreach to our Spanish-speaking fellows and non-fellows in Central, South America, and the Caribbean. So please do mark your calendars, and please do think about joining us for those events. Thank you all for being here. We really appreciate your time and your interest in this presentation. The idea behind this is to talk about how the International Academy exists and supports attorneys around the world, because families are increasingly mobile. To build any family law practice, you first need clients. And to build an international family law practice, you first need clients with an international issue. Not necessarily international conflict, and there's a difference. Not necessarily international litigation, but when you are engaged by a new client, sometimes the international issues are the most pressing, the most obvious. Sometimes those issues are more subtle, perhaps less challenging, but still present and part of what you can do to handle for your client to add value to the outcome and to make them feel like they've had a more complete and satisfying experience as your client. So once you identify those issues, whether it be a piece of real estate or a timeshare property, a bank account, something like that, that is your opportunity to develop the issue into actually being the attorney who handles it, into actually being an attorney who is handling an international family law issue. I took a look back at my own application to the IAML, as it was known at the time this morning, and that's a nice little trip down memory lane and remembering those clients. And I realized the issues ranged from contentious and complex to very amicable, and not necessarily things that were complicated to handle, but I needed help from other people. And that's where the IAML and the IAFL really can help you out. Whether you have a need to get records on a failed investment from outside of your own country, whether you have real estate that needs to be evaluated and you need to find your best local appraisers, whether you need to deal with employment benefits flowing from a prior or current employer, whether you do have those complex and contentious custody issues or simply the need to safeguard children's international travel, or whether it's a huge, big mess, which is my personal favorite war story, which was recovering assets from a so-called irrevocable international trust. So excuse me, I'm going to rush to the finish line. And I'm going to tell you the answer on how you become and develop an international family law practice. The answer is you have to do it. You have to look for the issues, find the issues, and tackle the issues. If you are not yet a fellow in the IAFL, if you are a junior associate or starting attorney, look for those opportunities and ask for those opportunities. The fellows here, the fellows in your firms, the fellows in your community are here to help you and guide you. We know, this panel knows, that it's much easier said than done. And this is where all of our speakers are going to help you. We are going to introduce each other as we go along, which is why I have not yet introduced any of the speakers. They're going to introduce each other to keep things flowing. I have the privilege of introducing our first speaker, coming to you from Paris, France. Isabelle Rennes is a fellow of the International Academy, and she will be talking to you about where we start and how we begin to develop that international practice. Isabelle, thank you for being here this morning, this afternoon, this evening, wherever you are.
Yeah, beginning of the evening. Thank you, Amanda, and thank you for the privilege of speaking amongst so many friends. I have chosen to tell you about the top 10 tips on how to practice international family law. And I'm aware that by mentioning top 10, I'm rubbing salt on fresh wounds, because it reminds us of this little traveling guide that we take everywhere we go on an IAFL meeting, and we do sorely miss those times. But at least we have other ways of reaching to each other, like those webinars. And it is not all about traveling. So my first tip is speak English. That's a must. And that's really how it started for me. because the first time I did any international law, I had no idea of what I was doing. I mean, really no idea. Some clients must have suffered. But what I had is that I spoke English and I was the only one speaking English in my firm. So that's really how it started. And you know, by position, if you have knowledge, but you cannot communicate with your clients, then you're in really in a difficult position. So yeah, speak English is number one, and also the first requirement to join the IAFN. Second tip is be open. And when I mean open, I mean sensitive to cultural differences. It could be religious belief, for instance. It's difficult to explain to a foreign client that is Sharia divorce is not going to be recognized in France, but he may have the same sensitivity when you know, you explain to him that his law is discriminatory. So all this takes some delicacy and some openness of mind. Also to be open, because if you want to explain your system to a foreign client or to a foreign lawyer when you collaborate between each other, you need to be informative, but you also need to be able to be critical towards your own system, because you must take a step back and look with some perspective to shed the light on the differences, because most of the time this is what you need to do to find the differences between two systems to find the best jurisdiction. Number three, be friendly. Do a little favor. If somebody calls you to ask you something about French law, it doesn't immediately have to be commercial. You can do it for free. You can give a little advice. This is also what you do when you call a friend and have a little advice. And that's one of the very, very big parts of the IAFN, being able to call somebody on the spot, ask a little question, and that question can make all the difference in the world, because it's going to give you the immediate answer that you would take hours finding in a book. And sometimes you don't have the luxury of time. This is how you build a network. And really, the network is how you get your clients, but also how you bring to your clients the immense satisfaction of finding them the proper lawyer elsewhere. Because in the end, it's not just about getting the referral, it's also about sending your clients with confidence to somebody you trust. And again, that's one of the perks of the IAFL. You get to meet people, you get to talk to them, you get to know them enough to know who you can trust with your precious client. Number four, be extra careful. It's a scary territory, international law. Your own law can be scary. When you get to foreign law, you are in uncharted territory. So you need somebody there to do the map for you, do the roadmap, and help you get there. Again, the network. And be extra careful to choose the right jurisdiction, because of course that's, you know, choosing jurisdiction in a way, it's choosing the law applicable. So that's a very, very big step. And there comes a but. Be careful, but number five, be quick. International law is a race to the court, sometimes race to the jurisdiction, to the decision, but mostly race to the court. And sometimes it's a question of minutes. We've had a lot of Eurostar divorces, a lot of Thalys divorces, and that's a very important part. Number six, be practical. It's really nice to get a wonderful decision, but if you're not going to be able to implement it, it's, you know, just money thrown by the window by your client. You need to find out where the assets are. You need to find out where it's going to be enforced. You have to be able to compare expected gain by the cost of filing somewhere else with foreign lawyers on top of you. So you really have to be practical in those things, even though international law can sound very theoretical. It mustn't be just the realm of the ideas. It must be very, very down to earth sometimes.
Isabel, I'm sorry to interrupt you. We yes. have run out of time for your top 10. Can you give us the quick top 10s sure. and introduce the next segment?
Absolutely. Be remote. We were already, and when you do international law, you have to be. Be creative. Find a solution that travel everywhere and be inspired. You can use the process from other countries like collaborative law, family arbitration, hearing the voice of the children, and bring them back in your own country. And my last one for the world will be grateful that we have such wonderful organization where we create knowledge and friends. I'm passing the ball to Robin Taub from Maryland, where they had an election recently, but the scores were a bit tighter than the scores of satisfaction for the IAFL that reached over 95% from a recent survey. And Marguerite Woodstock Whaley, Queen Consul from Barbados in the Caribbean, who are going to tell us how they collaborate on divorce cases. Thank you.
Thank you, Isabel. Welcome, Robin and Marguerite.
Yes, thank you and welcome. Robin and Ev have been asked to speak to you about the potential scope of international collaboration and a case that we worked on together. I practice in various islands in the Caribbean based in Barbados and Jamaica, and Robin practices in Maryland in the US. Now, Robin is involved mainly with negotiation, mediation, and collaborative law. As she says, anything but litigation. And whereas litigation is a major part of my practice. So we thought it useful to speak to you from those two perspectives and then discuss the specific case that we worked on together. So I'm speaking on litigation, and there are several cases, but in the time allowed, I'll just mention two. What's very important in litigation is to recognize the different judicial approach when you are involved in a Hague Convention country, and those countries which have not signed the convention or who have signed but not been ratified, as is the case in Jamaica and Barbados. So the first case that I would mention to give as an example, the parties actually lived in Cyprus. The father was born there, but the mother was a British national who also had Canadian citizenship. And there was a prohibition on the children leaving Cyprus. But in violation of that order, the mother left the country with twin young boys. They were 4 years old. They were thought to have gone to England, and that is where my mentor, or my introduction to IAFL, Anne-Marie Hutchinson, became involved. And she got orders there, assuming that they had gone to, it felt they were in the UK. As it turned out, they had gone to Turkey, to Colombia, and then ended up in Barbados. We later discovered that she had actually researched countries that had not signed the Hague Convention, and that was one reason she turned up in Barbados. And we were able to use this case as something persuasive to our Attorney General to get that to get signed up. The fact is, though, that within hours of us being contacted in Barbados, we were able to obtain orders making the children wards of the court and prohibiting them leaving and serving that on all ports of entry. When the matter went to trial, the mother claimed she had married a Barbadian in England and that she'd be in danger if she returned to Cyprus and the judicial system there would be unfair to her. So the judge insisted on hearing evidence, and literally whilst I'm on my feet, obviously it was being done fairly urgently. So even whilst cross-examining on my feet, my junior was able to be in touch with Anne-Marie in England, the attorney in Cyprus, getting information which I could use also in cross-examination, etc. The copy of the marriage certificate, et cetera. We needed an opinion from the attorney in Cyprus. We needed information on the judicial system. before the judge would give the order. We even needed information from the Attorney General in Cyprus regarding the warrant that had been issued for the mother's arrest.
Marguerite, thank you. That's a wonderful example. I do want to make sure we leave enough time for you and Robin to tell your personal story about how the two of you worked together. And I want to keep the program moving. So could we switch gears and talk about that collaboration between the two of you?
Yes. Well, I'll let Robin have.
Okay. I will. I'm going to jump to that in a second. Well, I'll start with that. First of all, Marguerite and I met because I was representing, my practice, by the way, is very international because I do a lot of DC work. So I do a lot of work for ambassadors, IDB people, IMF, World Bank. And this is, I had a client who was a Barbados diplomat. I don't want to give any more information than that, but the case was pending in Maryland. It was a Maryland case, and we needed counsel in Barbados because we wanted to file in Barbados. The law would be more favorable. So we were fortunate enough to meet Marguerite, who became co-counsel in our case in Barbados. We filed for divorce, got a divorce quicker in Barbados, and the laws were more favorable. The question became whether the court in Maryland would honor the rulings of the court in Barbados. And it was very interesting because there was a World Bank pension at issue. And long story short, the case ultimately settled in Maryland, but I think the benefit of Marguerite and I working together was just terrific because it gave us some leverage in negotiating. But then we didn't even know each other at that point. And then we met at our first meeting for the IAFL in South Carolina, and we realized who each other were and when we've been friends ever since. But jumping back to the other point that Marguerite was talking about, my practice is I don't do litigation. I stopped doing that about 20 years ago. I've been practicing for 38 years. Been there, done that. And I love to negotiate. I do a lot of mediation and I do collaborative law. And I have found that being a member of the IAFL puts me in touch with people around the world. Like I mediated a case for an IDB person. They were both Spanish nationals. The mom was moving, or the wife was moving back to Spain with the child. So I needed a co-mediator in Spain to advise me on Spanish law for custody and child support, whereas DC law was applying for the rest of the case. So we actually co-mediated the case and I wrote the agreement and she wrote the part of the agreement on the custody and child support. And also in DC, we have so many people that are dual nationals or have property in various aspects, various parts of the world. Right now I have a case where there's property in the UK, Ireland, France, Geneva, and the US, which is why I'm involved. And we had to get counsel in various jurisdictions because the tax laws and transferring property are very different. And you need to make sure that you have that advice. And my go-to person is my mentor in this organization, Cheryl Hepfer. I'm like, who do I call about this? And she immediately provides me with numerous names and I can contact them and get information on the tax laws in connection with negotiations of property settlement agreements. I do a lot of prenups. And in all of those issues, it's extremely helpful. And to know that you can contact somebody and trust that they know what they're doing, because otherwise they wouldn't be a member of the IAFL, really just, you know, I used to do this before and I'm always wondering, oh my God, does this person know what they're doing? Am I gonna get this right? And it's a tricky world to be working in and you have to be very careful. But when I joined the IAFL a few years ago and Cheryl had been nagging me for many years, I realized how much I love doing the international work because my husband and I traveled a lot. He's an international tax lawyer. And now we have these resources. And I know that we're in a quick time frame. So I'm going to wrap it up. And hopefully I didn't talk too fast and you understood the benefits and how much Marguerite and I enjoyed working together on this.
Thank you. I want to do a shout out, although I'm not sure she's on the call, to Sue Moss, who begged and nagged me to join the IAFL. I think some of you may have had the same experience. And Robin or Marguerite, can I impose on you to introduce our next speaker?
Yes, I would like to pass this on to Caroline Harnois from Montreal, Quebec, Canada. And she's going to be speaking on the potential scope of international collaboration.
All right. Thank you, Robin. Good morning, everyone. So a lot could be said, actually, on how to build a practice in international family law. But let's say that I'll focus today on the importance of continuing legal education, on competency, and on knowing your own limitation. So I think to develop a practice in international family law, you first need to be an expert in your own jurisdiction. So an expert in family law and an expert on your own private international law rules. So that is on jurisdiction, applicable law, recognition of foreign judgments, and knowing the treaties, knowing and understanding the treaties, the international conventions your state has ratified. So not only knowing the law, but knowing how your courts apply it. So knowing your case law. So on top of that, I think it's very important to develop good reflexes in international cases or cases with international elements. So for example, being able to identify quickly whether there's a potential other jurisdiction or other state that may have jurisdiction over your case, knowing if there's a foreign law that could be applicable to your case or part of your case, and identifying whether the other state, in case of an international access arrangement, for example, is party or not to the Hague Convention. So all that you need to be able to have those reflexes. On top of it, I think it's important to have general knowledge about the law of maybe your neighboring states or the states with which you have a lot of interactions. For example, I practice in the province of Quebec, and our neighboring province is Ontario. So although I'm not an expert in Ontario law, it's important to have general knowledge because, for example, we have a lot of spouses or ex-spouses who live each side of our border. So maybe one spouse in Ontario, one spouse in Quebec. So we have potentially two jurisdictions for a divorce case. So if I represent the spouse in need of spousal support, for sure, to advise this client, I would advise the client to introduce proceedings or at least consider introducing proceedings in Ontario, where I know for a fact that the courts are much more generous with spousal support. And on the other hand, if I represent the payor, I'll make sure to advise him to quickly introduce proceedings in Quebec. So this is the type of general knowledge I believe is useful to have. But obviously, it's not enough to have this type of general knowledge. So you and in most family international family law cases, you know, you have to acknowledge that you are not enough most of the time. So you need to work in cooperation with competent lawyers from other jurisdiction, and you need to know these competent lawyers. So this is where, as we said, the IAFL becomes very useful because you do develop a real network of lawyers who are competent. And as Isabel say, that you can just take the phone and call, and you know that you can trust what they are going to tell you. So as an example, I had a case very recently at the end of the summer where there were possibly three possible jurisdictions, Quebec, Spain, and British Columbia. So within a day, I was able, or within a few hours, I was able to get in touch with a fellow in Spain and one fellow in British Columbia, have the client and the three of us coordinated and advise her on, you know, the pros and cons of proceeding in one jurisdiction or another. So you have to act strategically for the benefit of your client, even though it may mean that you are not going to litigate the case. And finally, I think continuing legal education is a must. It is crucial. You need to keep yourself educated. The world is changing. The world is becoming a smaller place. We have a lot of people moving from a state to another. So it's really important that you keep yourself educated both internally and I think in international forums such as the IAFL that really offers a large range of conferences, CLEs, seminars on all relevant subject to an international practice. So both on the financial side, as well as children work. So in a nutshell, that will be it for me. And I will introduce you to the two next speakers, Oren Weinberg from Toronto, Ontario, Canada, as well as Brent Seymour from Northern California, close to San Francisco. And the two of them will talk to you about the case they had where they had a jurisdictional dispute, including the UCCJA and the Hague case.
Caroline, thank you for introducing our next group. Before I let you gentlemen get started, this is Amanda Trigg again, moderating your group. You've gotten the flow at this point, and I wanted to let all of our folks who came in on the back end of the electronic entry know that the question and answer panel is open. Please feel free to post your questions there. We may try to answer them in real time, or we may hold them for the last half hour of this program, which will be a full question and answer period. And we will invite you to join all of the panelists on screen and have a more open dialogue about the international practice of family law. So Oren, Brent, I apologize for interrupting you, but did want to accommodate folks who came in at the back end of our electronic entry. Thank you, and please tell us your story about your case.
Thank you, Amanda. I'm gonna go first because the case started with me. I was contacted by a client in Canada, in Toronto, whose wife had come to the United States with the children for a vacation to visit her parents. And as is often the case, she didn't return. And while she was here with one of the children, she gave birth to another child. Then she filed for divorce. And so my client said, what do I do? I don't live in the United States, and I have never lived there except for a year when I went to school, which was many years ago. And I'm being asked to respond to this, and my children are being held in the United States. So what we decided we needed to do, and we needed to do very quickly, was one, we needed to contest jurisdiction because there was a lack of personal jurisdiction over the client for purposes of the divorce. Also, we had to argue that there was a lack of jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction, for any custody decisions by the California court, because the children, we would argue, were habitual residents of Canada. And also, we needed to get a divorce filed in Canada at the same time. So, to contest jurisdiction, I filed a motion for forum nonconvenience and to quash service of the summons, which had been personally served on my client in Canada. We argued that there was a lack of minimum contacts so that California could not exercise long-arm jurisdiction over our client. We also filed a motion for forum nonconvenience, which said that California was an inconvenient forum for purposes of the divorce. All the marriage had started in Canada. The marital domicile was Canada. The parties had lived all of their married life in Canada. Their children, well, the eldest child had been born in Canada, and the second child had been born in the United States during what was supposed to be a temporary visit. We also wanted to get the children back. And here's where I had a bit of a conundrum. It's very easy to accidentally consent to jurisdiction by asking a court for affirmative relief. And I tend to be very cautious in this area because it's very scary for malpractice concerns to accidentally consent to jurisdiction. So I did not want to ask the state court to return the children, to make an order to return the children, because that could be considered asking for affirmative relief. So on the erring on the side of caution, we decided that we would file a separate Hague action in federal court and actually file that the day after the hearing was in state court. So in state, at that point, I realized that if I was going to prevail on the forum nonconvenience, I would need to have an action, a divorce action filed in Toronto so that the court would feel comfortable in sending the divorce back to Canada because there were already proceedings initiated. So I immediately thought of my friend Sarah Bowlby, whom I had met at several chapter meetings. And these are one of the best things of the IAFL, are the annual meetings. There are chapter meetings for the U.S. And Canada, for Europe, for Asia and Pacific, and also the international meeting for everyone. And these are just wonderful, wonderful meetings that take place over a week and in wonderful places all over the world. So anyway, Sarah and I had met at several of these meetings and become friends. So I immediately thought of her and called her. Unfortunately, she was unavailable. So I asked for her partner, Oren Weinberg, because Sarah had spoken highly of him many times during our meetings. And so I felt very comfortable asking Oren to help. And he was more than happy to take this up and very, very quickly get a divorce filed in Ontario for us. At the state court hearing, we prevailed. The court found that it did not have jurisdiction over custody for the eldest child, because the eldest child's habitual residence was Canada. The judge was kind of confusing Hague and jurisdictional terms, but we didn't argue with him. For the younger child, the judge was unsure of what the child's habitual residence was. So he left it and he said, well, I'm not going to split these kids up. And so I'm declining jurisdiction, custody jurisdiction. He also found that it was California was an inconvenient form. And furthermore, there had been some allegations of domestic violence against my client, and the judge found that Canada was an appropriate jurisdiction to handle that since the alleged acts had occurred in Canada. So then we went to the Hague case, and that started proceeding. But at that point, the case got turned over to Canada, and the parties started to negotiate, and we put the Hague proceedings on hold, and they're still on hold. And during the time that those proceedings have been on hold, the law on habitual residence in the United States has changed. Due to a Supreme Court case called Monaschi v. Taglieri. And we're hoping that we don't have to proceed with the Hague case now because it's very uncertain. Before, we had a very, very good argument, and the Monaschi case opens everything up to the court can use a totality of the circumstances standard to determine habitual residence. So you really don't know what's going to happen. The judge has an incredible amount of jurisdiction. I think I've spoken over my time, and I turned over to Oren.
Thanks, Brent. So as Brent said, we got retained and hit the ground running as fast as possible because it was really important to move quickly. And we started a proceeding for divorce and parenting orders and requests for property division. And that, in effect, created a problem for the mother because she had court timelines imposed upon her to respond to the case and make disclosure that we demanded and gear up for a fight in two jurisdictions. And that move, along with Brent's successful quash motion and the pending Hague application, created leverage that our client was able to use to his benefit to try and negotiate a resolution that worked for the family. And that negotiation has been going on for quite some time. So the proceeding here was put on hold, so to speak, and then got further delayed here because of COVID and the court shutdown. But even though the negotiations are still pending, now that the courts are back up and running, that leverage still exists. And I'm more than confident that between counsel, we'll be able to resolve the case for the family, because it's doubtful that, I think it's doubtful that the mother would really want to have a fight in this jurisdiction, whether whatever happens with the likelihood of the Hague outcome in the US. But one of the interesting things about working on this file is I have no doubt that because of the relationships that were cultivated within the organization, Brent and I had access to knowledge and expertise that allowed us to provide excellent service to our clients. And that is a big benefit of being part of this organization. And in addition to that, there were, in our case, some interesting cultural elements to this that were much more easily navigated by having a colleague like Brent, for example, to help me deal with our client in certain times, and I'm sure for him helping me being able to help him deal with our client. So again, another advantage of having colleagues by being a member of the IAFL. That's about it for me. I think at this point, I'll pass it on to our friend in Chile, Juan Francisco Zaricueta, who's presenting on personal relationships that are formed in the practice of international family law and the benefits of that for his clients.
Okay. Thank you, Aaron. Well, I want to talk a little bit about some of my, from my point of view, the advantages of being part of the IFL as a fellow. One of them, it's that you have a source of knowledge regarding family law from many different countries and jurisdictions. This also includes procedural law, which is really interesting because it allows you to understand how the courts rule are in different jurisdictions and how that impacts in the length of the trials. And this also helps to explain your clients the step that the process is going to have abroad. Now, recently, I have a case from a client from Chile in Atlanta, Georgia. And the colleague who is dealing with this case there, it's a fellow from the IFL. And it has been really good for the benefit of the client because the client, of course, as in many cases of family law cases, he's very anxious about the outcome of the case. So he's always asking about the different steps of the procedure, the length of the trial, and what means every steps. And because we have this relationship with my fellow from Atlanta, it's easier to explain the outcomes and the meanings of every step. I think that's really important. The same happens when someone who needs to have a case here in Chile needs to be to explain the different parts of the process. As our first colleague talked about the different tips, she talked about this one also. So it's really important to give this information because it's in the benefit of on the clients. But for me, there's also another advantage from being part of the IFL. It's about that you have not only professional bonds, but you also build a friendship bonds with your colleagues. Because as many of my previous colleagues said, we have the opportunity to know each other not only by the webinars, but like it used to be in the past, in different seminars. So in that activity, you have the opportunity to learn a lot during the educational program. But also in all the leisure activity, you have the opportunity to meet persons and know a little bit more about them and how they handle the international family law practice. And of course, that gives you trust in order to contact one of them if you need a little bit of advice, or even if you need to refer a case directly to some other colleagues. So for my experience, I have this huge source of knowledge, but also friendship with a lot of colleagues. If I need something from, I don't know, from Florida, from Canada, from Spain or UK or from different many different countries of the world, I know that I can contact one of my IFL fellows, and they will give me advices, and they will be better for the benefit of my client at the end of the day. Well, I guess I was so fast, but I don't want to use more time, so I want to introduce now my two dear colleagues, Mudita Chawla from New York and Elizabeth Hinks from London, England, who are going to tell you about the representation of a client in a prenuptial and a postnuptial agreement. So please welcome to Mudita and Elizabeth.
Thank you very much, Juan. Good evening from the UK. I practice in London, which is part of the jurisdiction of England and Wales. And I'm just going to talk with Mudita a little bit about how we came to work together and why, a brief overview of the case and key takeaways. So how we came to work together, Mudita and I met in Melbourne, which was the worldwide conference. And Ali, who is the executive assistant behind the scenes and is hopefully going to put up a photo now, that is me and Ali, and you'll note the wig that I'm wearing, which I'll come back to at the end. And the reason for that was that Mia, who was the president at the time, at the president's dinner on the Saturday night, which is always a great get together, the theme was ABBA, so Ali and I obviously took that to our hearts. So that's how we met, and Mudita was up that evening as well, and the two of us were sitting next to each other at dinner and really got chatting. We'd met each other before, and I think for me one of the key things about the IFL is that it's more than just a professional networking group. It's where you actually really meet people. And Mudita, do you want to say a few words on that?
Absolutely. Thank you, Liz. So as Liz said, we met in Melbourne, which is one of the most fun conferences that I've been to, not only because Melbourne is an amazing city, but also because the IAFL did such an amazing job organizing not only the educational programs, but also the entertainment, the activities that they organize for us. So as you've heard from everyone so far, the IAFL is not only a professional organization, but really an organization where you meet like-minded people who love to travel, who care about learning about different cultures, learning about different people, and you find very like-minded people. And my experience with other attorneys and fellows in the IAFL is if I've ever had a question about Canada, about the UK, about Australia, even New Jersey, we reach out to each other. We'll get on the phone and speak to each other, you know, whether it's a 5-minute call, whether it's an hour call. And having that built-in network of other attorneys who you can trust and rely on to give you real-time advice only makes you a better attorney, which is what, at the end of the day, I think all of us are trying to do, is to become better attorneys so we can offer the best level of service for our clients.
Absolutely. And that was why, having met Mudita, when I had a case which needed some input from the US and from New York, I thought of Mudita. So very, very briefly, I was instructed by a lady who'd been a model, who was in her very early 30s. And it's true to say she didn't have a penny or a dime to her name. And she was marrying a very, very wealthy multimillionaire chap who was in his 60s. And he did have quite a lot of money. And she was American, he was British. It was a second marriage for him. And for completely understandable reasons, he wanted to have a prenuptial agreement. They had homes in America, various places, but particularly in New York and also in London as well. And hence why I needed some input from a great lawyer in New York. And I thought of Mudita. So Mudita is going to tell us a little bit about some of the issues that we had to deal with.
So when Liz contacted me, the most important thing was for Liz and I to determine how the law in New York differed from the law in the UK, because that would obviously impact which country we wanted to have control any
enforcement of a prenuptial agreement, or also down the road, any divorce if that were to happen. So we discussed the issues of maintenance. We discussed issues of equitable distribution. We discussed the intestate share that a party would be entitled to absent a prenuptial agreement in the death, in the event of the death of the other spouse. We also had another issue. As Liz said, our client did not have a lot of money and she had borrowed money from her fiance. And so we had to classify whether that loan was a loan that had to be repaid in the event of a divorce or whether it was going to be deemed a gift to her. So once we identified how the law differed in the jurisdictions, we were then able to craft an agreement that protected our clients' needs as best as we could. Liz, did you have anything to add on that?
Yeah, Madhita, I think that was one of the key points is obviously prenuptial agreements, there's the legal aspect and there's obviously the emotional aspect because the clients are in love and they're getting married. So we had to tread very carefully. And the way that we dealt with it, because they were living in London and I was the primary lawyer, I guess you could say, on the case because the client had come to me initially. So although my communication with the client was, I was the key person dealing with that, Madhita also met the client, albeit by telephone, because one of the conditions of the agreement was it was clearly documented that the client had to have New York advice and in particular had to have various aspects of that New York advice explained to her. And Madhita had to sign off on the agreement as well. And we had a number of telephone conversations, Madhita and I, between the two of us, where we were looking at the draft agreement and Madhita would look at the draft and she'd give some input and some comment on it. Then she and I would discuss it. And then once we had a version that we were happy with, then we called the client and the two of us would talk the client through different aspects of that agreement and the key advice from an English and Welsh perspective and also from a New York perspective as well. And again, Madhita, I don't know if you wanted to comment on that.
Yeah, I think the most important thing was that Liz and I liaised with each other. And like Liz said, once we were happy with what we had, that's when we were able to reach out to the client to make sure she understood what she was signing, to make sure she understood the ramifications of her decision, and to make sure she understood that in the event there was a divorce, what she would have been entitled to absent a prenuptial agreement and what she was now agreeing to be entitled to pursuant to a prenuptial agreement.
And I think it's fair to say that between us and with the client's help, obviously, we managed to get a pretty good deal for her in the unlikely event that they do ever get divorced. And it was really interesting for me because I ended up having to go to the American embassy with the clients and the other lawyer in order to sign this agreement, which was an experience in itself because the American embassy in London is always absolutely ram-packed. But they got married and that was all great. And then the next step was a postnuptial agreement. And by that stage, not only did we have New York and the UK, but we also had a third jurisdiction because they were spending a lot of time in Italy. So that was one where Madhita and I again discussed the postnup, went through it between the two of us. And then I also had to bring in another fellow from Italy as well to go through things. So it was a truly international experience and really helped, obviously, by knowing Madhita and having got to know Madhita in Melbourne. So Madhita, do you want to talk about some of the key takeaways?
The most important thing to know about the IAFL is you're going to meet amazing people who are always ready to help. It's, like I said, it's not just a professional organization. It's also an organization through which you can build real camaraderie, you can build lifelong friendships, and you get excellent continuing education. You learn so much about the different jurisdictions, you meet amazing people, and you also have a lot of fun.
Absolutely. And to conclude, what I would say is come to the meetings, make friends, and borrow a wig. And now, Madhita, do you want to introduce our next speaker?
Yes, thank you so much for joining us. And now I'll turn the ball over to Fred Siegel, who's our esteemed fellow from Connecticut.
Thank you. That was great. You know, people who know me know that I don't clear my throat in less than 6 minutes. So this will be a real challenge. So, you know, with the IFL or developing an international practice, it's really all about relationships. It's about starting them, developing them, and maintaining them. And it's much more of a challenge today, probably, with the way the world is. But you can do it by Zoom conferences, by emails. And I think in order to develop the international practice, you want to keep up those relationships. You know, think of someone that you haven't talked to in a while and send them an email or phone them or do something so that you're sort of in contact and they're thinking about you and you're thinking about them. It's also important when you're developing the practice to let your local bar, your local world know that you're up for these cases and that you're going to do these cases, that you're going to be a source that they can come to. I mean, one of the things that the IFL has given me is that I know pretty much that if someone has a problem anywhere in the world, I can find a lawyer who can be helpful to them. And that's a resource that I don't think I had, I know I didn't have before I joined the Academy. And actually, if you are a fellow of the Academy, you become a fellow of the Academy, you get a little, I don't know if it's called an icon or something, but you put it on your signature of your emails and it identifies you as being a IFL member. I'm not sure how many people actually use that, but it's a good thing for the world to know that, yes, you can handle international cases. And I don't think you can practice family law without being exposed and without having a need to know international law and to know people that practice all over the world. It's also important, obviously, when you get into these cases, and you can even do it before, is to get educated, is to know the facts, know the interaction, make sure that you consider every angle, and is there an international aspect to the case, whether the people are citizens of your country, whether there are agreements, whether there are assets. You want to get educated. And a lot of people, you know, they hear the word international and they get a little bit worried, like, oh, I can't handle that kind of a case. But the reality is, you know, maybe it's a little bit more complicated, but you really can do these cases. And again, with the help of lawyers in the different countries or places, it's very easy to do so. So you can't say, well, I can't do them. I mean, if you know how to do family law where you are, you can do the international aspects of it. And the nice thing is that you're not alone. You have somebody to share the work and share the responsibility. And I look at international cases as really being more challenging than the typical, you know, where you have just the lawyers and everything is in your state. I find it actually has made the practice of law more enjoyable for me because you do get to learn what the law is and what's going on in different places. So I find that to be, you know, one of the challenges, not that matrimonial law is not generally challenging, because whether you're practicing in Europe, in Asia, wherever, we all know that clients tend to be challenging no matter where they are. And I think we all share that frustration. So, you know, this program has been a big plug, I guess, for the IFL, but it really is, it's really true. So I belong to a lot of legal organizations, and I don't think that I have found better people than the people that I have found in the IFL. People are extremely welcoming. So if you come in as a new member, you know, you're not a new member, a new fellow very long, because people are very, people go up and people, again, even if it's remotely, we can do it. But people go out of their way because they want to expand their network. And the way you develop this international practice is by developing that network and working on it constantly. You know, I've been with the Academy. I've been to Argentina, Iceland, Australia, Budapest, Mallorca. So, yes, the travel is great. But if it wasn't for the people, you know, you don't need the IFL to travel the world. You can do it on your own. But to be in these places with these very special people where you have an opportunity to meet new people, to learn about how things are going in other countries and what their issues are. And the IFL, we do look to do really good work and to take on causes that are not getting the attention that they deserve. It's really something that, you know, has really enhanced my career as a family lawyer. And again, I look forward to the interactions. I look forward to the challenges, and I just really enjoy the people. So I think I will send it back to Amanda, and I thank you.
Thank you, Fred, and thanks to all of our panelists and to those of you who have started populating our Q&A with some questions that we're going to open on the floor. As you've all heard from this group, I hope what's come across to those of you who are just listening as you've watched their faces and you've heard the themes that are coming across is the enthusiasm that we all have, not just for the organization, but for the opportunity to work together in a way that enhances our clients' experience, in a way that gives more value to our clients, in a way that hopefully enables them to get a little closer to their happily ever after when things have gone awry or where they're trying to send them in the right direction. We are at this point going to go ahead and open up the floor to anyone who wants to join us and move into the open discussion portion of the meeting. If you want to come on screen to join us, please feel free to use the raise your hand feature at the bottom of your Zoom screen. Panelists, you can stay put. The first people we are going to admit onto the screen, however, are two of our International Academy of Family Lawyer VIPs. We get a lot of our energy, a lot of our strength from our leadership. And today I am pleased, as soon as I can get them on screen, let's see if I can get a full gallery view here. Oh, I do see that I have William Longrigg is on screen, and here comes Rachel Kelsey. And we welcome you both. William is a past president of the International Academy. Rachel is a future president of the European chapter. And please, the floor is yours as we get other people into the room and start to populate our questions to tell us a little bit about what it means to you to have us in your academy.
Amanda, thanks very much for that. I've agreed with Rachel that I'm just going to say a few words first of all. We've heard from the panelists a lot, and I completely agree with all of it, about how great it is to be a fellow of IAFL. But I just want to talk a little bit about what IAFL can do for you before you're a fellow, and in anticipation of you being a fellow. I mean, many of you may not be 10 years qualified yet, for example. And I know that a lot of people on this webinar are people who are currently not fellows of IFL. So I do want to address you. Rachel's going to be talking to you a little bit about criteria, but I just want to talk a tiny bit about the background, really, of IAFL. And first of all, a lot of people say, particularly Cheryl Hepfer, who many of you will know, will say this used to be a travel club. This was a kind of travel club for people who did big money divorces. This has changed really significantly. The IFL's reach is far, far wider now, quite right too. And of course, IFL is now heavily involved in making a difference to the practice of family law throughout the world and also in many areas of family law, much wider ranging. So, for example, we're dealing with abduction and adoption and surrogacy and forced marriage and issues that we were never involved with 15 or 20 years ago, which was when I became a fellow of IAFL. And in particular, what we've really taken it upon ourselves to do is to provide education on international family law as far as we can throughout the world. And that's really what I want to talk to you about. There are many opportunities for those of you who are not fellows to meet other like-minded individuals who are involved in the practice of family law and who are learning about, or who already know probably quite a lot about in many cases, the practice of international family law. So we have three types of what we call mini meetings. And the mini meetings are available for people who are not fellows. Of course, non-fellows can also come to our main meetings as well, but these other meetings are specifically designed for non-fellows. And the three types of mini meetings are the introduction to international family law meetings. And in particular, we've had a whole series of those based in Europe. We've had one in Berlin, one in Madrid, one in Warsaw. We've actually got a virtual one coming up in March in Kiev. And these are incredibly well attended, always more than 120, 130 people coming along, meeting each other. Of course, there are lots of IFL fellows there too. But as I say, they are designed for non fellows. We've done very similar thing in the US, in New York, and in San Francisco. We've also carried out a lot of other meetings, which are essentially regional family law meetings, where they are very similar to the introduction to international family law, but they've been specifically arranged in order to bring people together from a particular region. So we did one in Dubai, where we brought a lot of people together from all the different countries in that region. We've also done several before main meetings. So we did one in Delhi, for example, where a lot of Indian fellows came, again, specifically designed for people who are not fellows of IAFL. We've also, unless I did this actually with Rachel Kelsey, who you're about to hear from, we've been to Ghana, we've been to Botswana, we've been to Nigeria, again, to sort, I'd say, regional meetings in terms of that type of mini meeting to get people together as far as possible, to talk to them about IAFL, but also, importantly, just to talk about the practice of international family law. So the third type of mini meeting is the symposium, where we have a specific topic. And sometimes, for example, before a main meeting, we will have a day where we discuss a specific topic, whether it's to do with child abduction or something else to do with children issues. We had a whole 2-day conference in London, which was around surrogacy, where we had 32 different jurisdictions represented. And of course, we dealing with other issues such as Brexit and so on. So I do want to say to you, there are a lot of opportunities. Look on the website. There's a lot that you, as a future fellow or a potential fellow of IAFL, can really do to increase your knowledge and to meet other people in this area of the law. And of course, I would say I speak for really pretty much everybody that I know on the management and on the executive of IAFL. We are really happy to speak to people on the telephone or to communicate with people by email if you just want to get in touch with us and have a word about what it's all about. And of course, Donna Goddard and Ali Massey are there as well. So thanks very much for giving me this opportunity for that plug for the non-fellows. Thanks, Amanda.
William, while we have your attention, though, would you or Rachel please speak to the question of what's expected of fellows when they first join, or what's available? Are there automatic participation requirements? Is there anything you must do once you cross the threshold?
I think probably I'll hand over to Rachel on that, because she's going to be talking about the criteria for joining. But the short answer is, once you join, there are no requirements for anything that you have to do. Some people join and we don't see anything of them for years and years and years, but they remain fellows. We of course hope that they will become involved and that we'll see a great deal of them. But I think, Rachel, you could probably deal with that.
Yeah, and I'll start by correcting you, William. There is
as usual,
exactly. There is one criteria that is a lifelong criteria, which is that you have to be nice. I think that is a common thread across all of the fellows. It was something that Fred said, and others have said, that these are people that you become very close to and become your friends. I should obviously have been concentrating completely during all of you talking, but a number of people have had various text messages from me saying that they look very nice and they're doing very well and things like that, because you do develop real friendships with people from all over the world. So a little bit about the criteria and process. The first thing to say is that we now have frequently asked questions, which we didn't have before, which is on the website. So if you are interested in applying for fellowship, go onto the website. There is actually quite a lot of information on there, which we hope will answer some of the obvious kinds of questions that people have. But the sort of to follow on, the sort of to do an Isabel and give you some top tips, there are few common themes that we see coming through, and people asking us, because they don't know how to go about applying, that it's probably worth sharing. And I think many of us who are fellows will tell you that the experience that we had was, we got the application form, we filled in the easy questions about your name and your address, and then you gave up and you stuck it in a pile, and you thought, depending on where in the world you were, that was going to be a job for I don't know, Eid or a job for Christmas or a job for Thanksgiving or something, but you would come back to it. And many of us have, we have all had this common experience of having sat on it for too long. And so I would say one of the main things is don't sit on it too long. It's not an exam question. We're not trying to trip you up. We want people to be able to join us if you are suitably qualified, and we will support you and help you to become fellows. So the main top tips, number one, don't be downhearted if you get a knockback first time. There are many people who have not got in on their first application. Most managed to get in before their fifth or sixth. William, how long did it take you? Seven, eight?
It was only my second time, thank you very much.
Yes, so, but yeah, even Mr. Longrigg didn't get in first time. So don't be disheartened if you don't get in first time. We do take membership very, very seriously. And the criteria that we have are looked at carefully and are thought about. And your application will be considered by an admissions committee from the chapter area that you're from, or if you're from a rest of the world jurisdiction, you're not in a chapter area, it will be reviewed, and it will be reviewed carefully. As William said, one of the main criteria or main starting points is you have to be at least 10 years qualified. So if you are less than 10 years qualified, and I think looking at the list, there are certainly, I see some names certainly of people who I recognise the names who are not yet 10 years qualified. Start thinking about it early and thinking about what sort of cases you would have to talk about or to think about, who are the people that you've come across professionally, and start doing that early. If you are in a jurisdiction where you don't know fellows, so there aren't other fellows in your jurisdiction or there are very few, get in touch with us because we will support you, we will mentor people, we will put you in touch with other people so that you can get to know fellows in your region or in other places where you have done work before, so that you can start to get to know about the organisation before you put an application in. And if you are in a part of the world or a city where there are fellows, reach out to those fellows, because it is quite likely that we will take soundings from fellows. So not just the referees that you have given us the names of, but we will take soundings from other people about the nature of your practice, what kind of work you do, whether you're held in high regard and so on. So reach out to them and see whether they will support you with your application. And they will probably be able to tell you whether you are likely to be at the right kind of level or whether you need a bit more experience or something like that. And that then brings us to the final and most important bit of the application, which is your referees. And we put enormous stock on the referees that you give us. We ask for two or three referees and think about, thank you, Medita. It's not helpful when I'm speaking that you send me messages.
I'll just remind the US chapter that when Rachel says referees, she tends to mean references.
References
or verification sources.
Yes, exactly. So what we ask you to do is to give us two or three people. The primary area where people often don't give us enough information or give us the wrong people is that they assume that what we're looking for is referees from out with your jurisdiction. Sorry, that's a Scottish word, from somewhere other than your own jurisdiction. And so they think that they have to find somebody internationally that they've worked with. Now, one of the main bits of our criteria is that you are going to be one of the most experienced and skilled family lawyers within your own jurisdiction. As Fred said, you are going to be somebody who knows how to work your domestic regime. As Caroline said, somebody who understands your international private law rules within your own country. And so we're going to need to know that you are held in that regard within your own jurisdiction. And then you also need to have a significant element of international work within your practice. But again, that may not be that you are going to give us an international reference in the sense of somebody from another jurisdiction, because somebody that you have done an international case within your own jurisdiction will obviously be aware of how you handle the international components. So those, I think, the referees are really, really important. But what I would say is I do genuinely believe that we are one of the nicest organisations. It's certainly the professional organization that I'm in that I have felt most at home and have really thoroughly enjoyed the most. So speak to people if you are not sure and you want some support, you want to talk through how you do the application, how much information you put in, how little you put in, tell us that and we will find somebody, we will buddy you up with somebody who will try and support you and help you and give you a bit of practical guidance on that. But I think that's probably, William will tell me if that's all inadequate or insufficient very quickly. Or Amanda, does that answer your questions? There are some issues from a US perspective. So US yeah. fellows, often you don't have to be a member of the AAML, but often that's our kind of gateway is you often come in through the AAML. And so certainly it would be good to speak to some of the AAML fellows who are also IAF fellows, because they will give you a feel for how, what, because it's a very different organisation. It's got a very different, it's got a very different focus. And we think of them very much as a sister organisation for us that we are very close to and want to work closely with. And it's not competition, it's closeness, really.
It's true. And it goes back to what you said, Rachel, that one of the things we really want is to surround ourselves with really nice people who are also really smart and who understand what we do. I do think that one of the benefits of the International Academy is that everyone who's in it understands what it means to get that telephone call or that email where your heart just clutches, because to Robin's point, you need really fast reflexes. You may have to jump on this. Isabel, that was one of her points as well, that you can't be afraid to act, because sometimes that's the only way to be protective. And clearly Brent and Oren had the same type of instincts. And so by following the guidance that we heard from Fred and Juan, you start to surround yourself with these people who can help you get through that because they know what it takes. And one of the things that we definitely want is to be able to learn from the example of the people who've gone before us. So I hugely appreciate William and Rachel's input. I want to just say to anyone else who's still listening, if you'd like to join us on the floor, so to speak, raise your little digital hand and we'll move you into the room. We do have a few more questions to address, coming from different perspectives, and we want to make sure that we get to all of those. Because one thing that has come up in the Q&A is the idea that when we deal with international conflict, this question about cooperative behavior and to what extent different jurisdictions recognize coercive behavior as a reason to give relief or to not give relief, to undermine a prayer for relief. And I think that's going to vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. But my question, perhaps for Isabel or for anyone else who wants to jump in, would be, you know, how do we as international practitioners who are not necessarily with boots on the ground meeting the clients for the first time face to face, how do you assess the emotional components and the personality components of representing international clients? But anyone, if you have some thoughts about that, if you could literally raise your hand, the floor would be yours to start to think about how you've dealt with that in your situations where you may have clients you'll never physically meet, especially now.
Maybe just to answer quickly the part about friends, because I think the case in the Q&R was about it was about friends. Well, the answer is probably not enough. We have a jurisdiction where judges have lots of cases. It is not a walls wise jurisdiction, like we say sometimes about England. Sadly, sometimes judges tend to rely a lot on a situation of fact, or what they perceive as having been the agreement. So in the case you were referring to where the wife had relocated to France, it was probably a very tough deal to establish that, yes, she had relocated to France, but she didn't want to come. The fact that she was there must have had a lot of bearing in the case. I pass on the ball to somebody else who has a different experience.
Mm-hmm. Derek, this was your question. Did you want to amplify the reasons you asked it without maybe getting into too many of the specifics?
No, well, two things quickly. With just a thanks for William and Rachel, but Rachel, I did have to have a third referee, and that was a struggle. Thank God, Roberta in Italy was. I just finished with a care case, and she'd been helping, so she was lovely, and that, I think that swung me over the line. Yeah, it's just that the argument over here was that the way the British courts look about emigration is about a joint decision, even if the husband does all the booking the hotel, booking the rentals, paying for the car or whatever. And I was arguing that, well, if you're under a coercive controlling husband in that instance, where's your free will? You can't say you've agreed to it if you've just been part of that for years. But Veronique was saying, Isabel, that in France, really, the domestic violence issues between a husband and wife don't necessarily import into the decision-making very much relating to what's going to happen to the children, whereas over here it would be a lot more significant.
Yeah, she's right, as always. I have the deepest regards to Veronique, who was actually my godmother in the association. So I'm not going to contradict her. It has slightly changed very, very recently, because there has been a few months ago a change in the law about the impact of violent behavior on the wife. Is now slightly becoming something that we regard as damaging for the children too. But it is true that until recently, we had sometimes judges saying, why are you talking to me about abuse to the mother? We're talking about the children here. So this is irrelevant, which is, I agree, shocking.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, I'm so pleased I'm in. I think if I just say to anyone listening who's not a member, it is an amazing first year that I've had. Just going in, even to the US chapter, is really interesting. Learning so much, and I should have done it years ago. That's what I think. Thank you.
Look at that, an unsolicited, unpaid, real person, not an actor, giving an endorsement of the IAFL. You know, one of the other points that I thought we might touch on, at least briefly as we wrap up, is this whole idea of leverage. Oren mentioned it, Robin mentioned it as well. And this idea that by collaborating and pulling together our teams, that we are able to create a better result for our clients. Mudita, Liz, did you feel like the leverage was something that you were bringing to the table in getting a better deal for your client as you maneuvered through these two phases?
Go on.
Okay, I think that because this couple had, well, the husband had property in so many different places, had we not addressed how it would be dealt with in the different jurisdictions, our client would not, at the end of the day, have been able to get as good a deal as we got her. Because I knew what New York law would entitle her to, we were able to ensure that she got some of those things drafted into the prenup to protect her down the road.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know if I'd say the word leverage. I think I'd say more it's working together to get the best result for the client, but always bearing in mind the nuances, as I said, when a couple are getting married, that, you know, you don't want to drive a Horton, we use the expression, horse and carriage through what's already in an agreement, for the simple reason that it's a couple in love who are getting married and you just want to make sure that you get the best deal. But ultimately, it's always the client's choice, and all you can do, and you know what Mudita and I did, was explain to her what the position was, what the position would be in New York, what the position would be in England and Wales. And then it's always the client's choice as to what they do with that advice. So I think the nuances on drafting a prenup are very different than, say, if you're going for a divorce and looking at the financial aspects of a divorce.
That makes perfect sense. And that does, I guess, begin to explain why the two comments came from the litigation teams. Fred, what do you think? Does leverage come into it? Unmute yourself.
I think knowledge is leverage. I think that I found that being in the IFL has made me a better lawyer. because I'm much more, you know, I know sort of the score in different places. So I do think that if you have allies in different jurisdictions, you are armed and you're better able to serve your client, and you can give a better prediction of what the outcome, and you know whether you should be fighting, you know, in England or fighting in Connecticut. So I think it's essential to have this knowledge and these resources. You know, it's a question of whether you consider yourself a serious lawyer. So to me, you know, if you're a serious American lawyer, you want to be in the American Academy of Matrimony Lawyers. If you're serious about practicing international law, you have to be in the IFL. It's like not even a question. You have to be.
Juan, I see you nodding enthusiastically. Is there something you want to add?
Oh, sorry. Well, I agree with the words of Brett, because I think there's always a lot of lawyers who say that they practice international family law, but at the end you discover that that's not true, because they don't know so much about foreign law. They don't have a good network of colleagues from another country. That's the difference when you meet someone from the IFL. It's they know a lot of people who work in this field in different countries. So that's the main difference. So that's the reason why I was nodding when Frederick was talking about that.
Nice when we agree with each other. We've spent a lot of time together at this point, almost an hour and a half. And I think one of the things I hope, if you are not yet a fellow of the Academy, that you will appreciate is that we tell it like it is. I have been really impressed with the fact that you can get straight answers and fair assessments of any legal question, including the yes or no sides to it, from anyone who has taken their practice to this level. And I would echo the gratitude that I was fortunate enough to do it. I would echo the gratitude to the people who supported me in applying to the Academy. And would just ask, before we sign off, I think we've covered all the questions in the chat about CLE and joining and the referees or referrals. I would just ask if anybody needs to give one more shout out to someone who helped them get into the organization or who have helped them in the organization, feel free. And if there are any more questions, you can literally raise your hand as an attendee, digitally raise your hand as an attendee, and I'll do one quick scroll through. But otherwise, I know that from coast to coast across the country, we've got people who are ready to end their day, and some of us who are going to wrap up on a day that's barely started. And I am so grateful to this huge panel, to this great panel of people who brought this vision to life. Medita, Isabel, Marguerite, Juan, Elizabeth, Fred, Caroline, Oren, Brent, Robin, Allie and Donna, especially from the main office. We do nothing well without you. We do it better with you. And William and Rachel, thank you for enhancing this experience for all of us by being the leaders who you are. If there are no other questions, I'm going to ask the panel to all give a wave, and we will say goodbye to you all. Farewell, adieu, adios. Much gratitude. Do not forget to check the IAFL website for the upcoming webinars that may be open to you as non-fellows, and to reach out to any of us who struck an interest or who you want to contact about becoming a fellow of the IAFL. We are cheerleaders for this organization, and we are cheerleaders for better experiences for our clients worldwide. And we'll be better if you join us. So please reach out to us. Let us know what we can do to get you to join. And checking the Q&A, some thank yous. We appreciate that, but no more questions. And I will let you all sign off. And thank you very much for your hard work and for your time. Have a wonderful week. And good luck in this holiday season, wherever your family may be.